This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
BBSRadio.com. Welcome to the Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and boy, do we have a good guest for you tonight. We have Lynn Mettaggart. We're going to talk about her new book, The Intention Experiment, her old book, The Field, and everything that she's doing right now in this just amazing work experiment that she's conducting. How are you, Lynn?
I'm well, Eva. It's great to be chatting with you.
Thanks for coming on. I've been waiting a long time for this interview. Been following you a long time.
Oh, that's so nice. Thank you.
So before we get started, why don't you take just a minute and tell everybody where to find you, a little bit about yourself, what your site is, where they can get your book, and then we'll get on into the interview.
Wonderful. Okay. I am author of The Intention Experiment and a book, The Field, and they can find me on livingthefield.com and theintentionexperiment.com. And I am an investigative reporter by trade. I look at a lot of evidence for what works and what doesn't work in medicine. That's where I came in. And I began finding studies demonstrating that, you know, very, very good studies of spiritual healing. And these were good scientific studies. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I was absolutely amazed because I kept thinking, well, this means that somebody can have a thought and send that thought to someone else and that person, other person can get better. And I kept wondering whether or not something major is missing in our understanding of how the world works. So I went on a quest and a journey to find out if there was anything, any scientists out there who could explain this to me. And I started talking to top physicists around the world. And they all gave me one little tiny portion of the same thing, which was that we exist in a giant energy field, that we're part of it, and that we're all connected. And also, they provided a lot of evidence to suggest that consciousness is a tangible energy that can change physical matter. And so I wanted to find out how this possibly could work. And so I began on my new book. My other, all that other material, I realized that I had to synthesize this into what was, seemed to be, a new science.
Mm-hmm.
And that each scientist had picked up a little portion of the same, of the puzzle. In a sense, but no one had really put it together.
Yeah,
and I realized, and was daunted by the idea that I had to do this, that this was going to be my job.
You have done a great job doing that, too, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
It's something that was, when somebody first turned me onto your book a couple of years ago, and I went, oh, my God, the work that this woman is doing is so important, because many of them, I mean, the small group, you know, with Dean and Tiller and Brendan and Bob John, you know, they know each other. But people like Henry Stapp,
mm-hmm.
you know, he doesn't know everything that's going on in the world right now, and he doesn't know what he doesn't know, and what you're doing is going to bridge that gap a great deal, I think.
Well, thank you. I mean, I suppose it's a great advantage for me not being a scientist, because if I can understand it, then I can communicate it. And
right.
I think what is difficult for many scientists is they're really used to speaking in code. They speak in math, and you know, they speak in those kinds of languages. And so it's difficult for them to really, you know, talk to a lay audience, I suppose, because they're used to dealing with these concepts in a different, you know, with different ideas and different
right.
words to describe them. So coming from the outside, I really had to understand this in a very basic manner, and the way to do that for me was really through metaphors and analogies and things. And so that's how I understood it, and that's how I can communicate it.
Well, one thing I'd like, that I personally have found out, I've been conducting a little experiment too over the past 2 years. What is consciousness? And I found that many of the scientists, even those within what I call our own group, you know, the core group of the bleep people and the secret people,
mm-hmm.
a lot of them, when you say, what is your definition of consciousness, will have a slight variation. So I've been trying to bridge that gap a little bit, so with making everybody aware of what do we think we're talking about when we use that word.
Mm-hmm.
So to get started, what is consciousness to you?
Well, consciousness, for one thing, I'll tell you what it isn't. It's not locked up inside our skulls. And we know this from a lot of the evidence that has been amassed on near-death experiences and comas. For near-death experiences, if the brain is a computer, as is portrayed by many neuroscientists, then this is a computer unplugged. This is a situation where people, any brain waves that they're measuring are flatlining. There's no activity there. Nevertheless, when these people come back from their near-death experience, they report with great clarity everything that went on in the room while they were supposedly dead. And they know all sorts of details. Similarly, people in a coma, again, with no supposed evidence of consciousness, demonstrate an awareness and a recall of all sorts of things that went on while they were in the coma.
Mm-hmm.
So consciousness, this would suggest consciousness is not locked up inside the skull, but is a something other that we tap into. Rather like a television set, we're being transmitted the information, and that the job of the brain is as a transducer, an interpreter of this.
What do you believe to be the transmitter?
I believe the transmitter is the field. I think that that has seemed to me to be a very good explanation of it. We know there is such a thing as zero-point energy, which is an energy exchange that occurs through particles, subatomic
right.
particles, and that this energy exchange creates this virtual vacuum, as they call it, which is the basically information in the space between things, and that is the we are all joined like one giant web with this, and I guess it is the alpha and the omega of our existence. So to me, consciousness is the field.
When an intention goes out, just talking globally here, have you gotten any ideas from any of the people that you've interviewed, or even from your own awareness? How does an original intention start to erupt?
I'm sorry, I don't really understand the question.
I guess what I'm asking is the God theory. How does the God theory get the original intention to erupt and go out so that something receives it?
Oh, you mean that who created the field?
Yes.
I have no idea. I think, was it always there? It's interesting. Some people have described the zero-point field as a sea of light. And, of course, we know in the Bible the first message is let there be light.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? I don't know. Some people say the Big Bang, it occurred with the Big Bang. I don't know. I mean, I tend to believe consciousness always was.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really believe there was a beginning to it.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Do you, let me see, I lost my train of thought just for a second. How do you think that it's conveyed? I have to use this word frequencies, but a lot of people have problem with that word. How do you think that mind interprets what it gets from consciousness? How does it receive it? Is it through signaling, maybe pulsed electromagnetic signaling, or how do you think it receives?
How does the brain receive consciousness, you mean?
Yeah.
I think the brain, as I say, is a transducer, and I like the ideas that Carl Pribram has on this, which is he sees the brain. I mean, Carl Pribram, when he was a young neuroscientist, participated in some gruesome experiments of rats, and they chopped up, mangled and burned a lot of the brains of these rats after training them with a little basic run. And no matter how damaged these poor rats were when they had very little brain left, they might have problems with their motor skills, but they always remembered the run. And that made Pribram think, as a young scientist, that maybe memory isn't stored in one particular place in the brain, but is somehow distributed all over, and that information is not necessarily contained in the brain. And he went on to find that the brain basically responds to, in ordinary reality, certain bands of frequencies. And the brain is basically, as I say, like a television set. It's picking up information from the field and interpreting that to the body, doing a bit of a transfer of this information and sending it around the body. So you're absolutely right. It's picking up frequencies. It's picking up waves. It's picking up waves of information.
Do you think that it goes in signaling like rat-a-tat-tat, you know, somehow these bands of the waves go in some kind of signaling like Morse code?
No, I think it's quantum information, and that the brain is picking this up and then does a transform of this for the body. So the brain's the antenna.
Right, but how would it... It's got to be conveyed in some manner so the brain can pick it up. Would that...
It's conveyed in quantum frequencies. It's conveyed as, you know, it's quantum information that the brain is picking up. And they know this. I mean, this isn't just a... I'm not theorizing on this.
Right.
Pribram has done a lot of studies of humans and animals, and found that the brain is responding to certain limited frequencies, and that is picking it up in frequency. It's picking it up in frequency and making some sort of transfer of it.
Does each level of conscious awareness, like in physical reality, from basic awareness in a rat or an amoeba to us, do you think that it's higher resonant frequencies the more intelligence that's attached?
No, I don't at all. I think we're the dumb people. I think animals, if you look at animals, animals live in the field. Animals are very psychic. They're very aware. They pick up all sorts of information. It is we who operate with very limited bands of frequencies, and we have to learn to be more like animals, where we're picking up much more intuitive information. I think they find in... You know, I think that what Pribram found was, in ordinary waking consciousness, we respond to almost only a limited bandwidth of information. And probably what goes on during psychic information is the bandwidth enlarges. And so I would have thought that animals seem to be privy to so much more information. They seem to be much more sensitive to a lot of different information than we are.
So it would be the opposite, like the animals would have... pick up the higher range of frequencies.
Well, I think we're all capable of that higher resonance, basically. But the problem is we've shut off so much of it. You get many people who are so-called sensitives or healers or Qigong masters or something like that. They're tuning in to many more frequencies, even children. But we just end up shutting off so much of that. But we're all capable of this much higher human potential.
What is your definition of mind?
Consciousness.
So mind and consciousness to you would be the same thing?
Yes.
Is there a big mind and a little mind? Is there some kind of gradient of mind?
No, there's only mind.
Okay.
And we're just picking it up, or not.
Okay. What about the source of creativity? What would that be? Would that also be...
I think we're tapping in again. I mean, and you find this with great geniuses. They talk about how they don't know how this came to them. You know, Paul McCartney wrote Yesterday. It appeared to him, word, you know, note perfect. And it's like he channeled it. So in many, many, many geniuses of all varieties talk about just downloading this information. And it would seem that they're picking up information from the field. So creativity, I think great moments of creativity are that moment of tapping in, just getting a little more information, widening the bandwidth, so to speak.
Now I'm going to go on into your specific things about your book. Those were just some questions that I had to ask.
Sure.
I wanted to know about. One thing I wanted to know, too, was Fritz Popp, did you actually get to go into his laboratory and see the work that he was doing with...
Yes.
With the biophotons. Tell me about that. I've been so interested in that.
Well, it's kind of wonderful because he's got all kinds of rooms. He's got a warren of rooms that I describe in my new book, The Intention Experiment. He was built and given this beautiful lab in an area with very futuristic buildings that is being sponsored by an eccentric millionaire who wanted a place for artists of all varieties to have. And he has eschewed that beautiful, big, open, airy building and picked an old army barrack because it was built on an old American army site in Germany to use that. So, and he's got a little warren of offices because he needs very small enclosed spaces for the work of counting living light, which is what he does. And he's got lots of equipment that can count the light coming off of living things, so basically photon by photon. And it's really fascinating that he's able to, you know, able to do this with his great equipment. One of the rooms has a pitch black room, and that's where he counts living, you know, the light coming off of human beings, for instance. And I went there because he and I were talking about doing one of the first intention experiments, and I went to see his lab and to talk to him about how we would set up a pilot experiment. And he's, you know, I think Pop is one of the great unsung geniuses. Happily, he's not so unsung. He's just appearing this month on the cover of Ode magazine, and I'm thrilled to see
that. That's wonderful.
Because he was vilified almost as a criminal for many years, and his work is an enormous, enormous contribution. The idea that all living things are dribbling out a light, a tiny current of light, but more to the point that this light is being picked up and replied to by other living things, that we're having this kind of a conversation of light all the time.
It's just amazing. I'm so enamored with his work.
Yeah, it's really brilliant.
All right, so how does your book, The Central Idea That Consciousness Affects Matter, differ from the world of classical physics? What does that mean to the general layperson?
Okay, it's simply this. All of our understanding of the world and our the definition we make of ourselves in relation to the world is very much dependent on the scientific story that we're told. You know, we live by the stories that we're told, and the scientific story really defines everything about us, how we live, about our inner selves, about our health, our place in the world, all of this. And before you know it, the scientific story becomes our truth, and it's how we create our life. And our, so far we've been living a Newtonian truth. In other words, we've been living according to our understanding of our world that occurred many hundreds of years ago, and they were the ideas proposed by Isaac Newton. Now, I have nothing against this in the sense that Newtonian science works very well in one regard, in the sense that I flew over from England a few days ago, where I live, and I flew on an airplane, and that is based on a brilliant, you know, technology based on Newtonian science. However, this scientific story is all about separate things operating according to fixed laws in time and space. And that's the understanding we have of the world. And we have another understanding of the world based on the Darwinian view, which is survival of the fittest, you know, that we're only, we're some sort of genetic mistake, you know, that we are used for our genes, and our genes operate through us blindly. And that whole concept has really created us and created our, created all of our structures, because from the scientific story, we've fashioned our relationships. You know, we believe ourselves to be separate. We believe the world out there to exist independently of whether we look or not. You know, we go to sleep and in our beds, and we feel comforted by the idea that once we go to sleep, the universe doesn't disappear.
Right.
But we also create our structures from this. We create we've created our relationships, our schools, our businesses, our economics, our societies, even our planet, on the idea that we are separate. Everything is separate, self-contained. And it's a very bleak vision. It's a very bleak vision. We honor the individual. We honor competition. We honor beating the other guy out. You know, zero-sum game. For every winner, there's got to be a loser. And that's the way we've created our whole life, based on this idea that we're separate.
Right,
and
reality.
And so this scientific story is about to be replaced with a new one, which is a quantum view, which says that no, things are not separate. They exist solely in relationship. There is not any me and not me. There's no more out there. we are all one. We're all connected. And we're all affecting each other at every moment. And once we really understand that, we understand that the old story has to be replaced by a new one, a new idea and a model of cooperation.
Well, I'm imagining doing what you do, you get in contact with a great deal of people in Western science, conventional science. How do they receive you?
It depends on who. But I think it's interesting for me to see that my audience kind of bridges a real divide. On the one hand, I've got a lot of people who are the so-called cultural creatives who are, you know, interested in some aspect of New Age thinking, whether that's from alternative medicine to wanting to manifest things in their life, law of attraction, to healers, to all sorts of people like that. But on the other hand, I have a lot of young scientists who are very interested in this work and want to see and are very interested in applying the new science and a new scientific story. So I think it's, you know, I've got the measure of both. Of course, there is a small part of the scientific community that are the skeptics or the skeptics with a, you know, meaning the close-minded.
Yes, that frustrates me a great deal.
Well, they're very vocal, very, very small minority, but a very highly vocal one. And they go around trying to discredit brilliant scientists like Rupert Sheldrake and the like. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating for me, too, because their arguments are not based on any information. You know, it's good to have a fair fight. I don't mind that. I don't mind having a good, solid debate with someone who's honestly got a difference of opinion or who really wants more proof. I'm ready and willing to provide that, but and happy to have, you know, a little spar. But this is just trying to destroy something because it doesn't fit in with their very fixed and close-minded view of the way the world works. And it's not science. That is not science. True science is exploration, being open-minded, being willing to discard something when something new comes along. Mm-hmm. That's what being an explorer is, and well, there are few of them around.
I had this very same conversation with Henry Stapp about Robert John and Brenda Dunn's work.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely refuses to accept that they had any credible progress with what they did.
Goodness.
I mean, he just will not hear it, and I
Goodness.
Just cannot understand that.
No.
You know, just because I don't think he understands, and I'd like your opinion on this because that was going to be one of the questions. I'm of the opinion that if you're going to have someone setting an intention,
mm-hmm.
that you have to get in some kind of altered state of mind so that you're cohesive, like Roland McCrady talks about
mm-hmm.
at HeartMath.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they take that into consideration when they're trying to reproduce the work so they don't have cohesive thought going on. And it's not going to work the same. Do you agree?
Well, no, in the sense, you're talking about Robert John and Brenda Dunn's work?
Yeah.
I think they tried a number of different protocols with their people. They found that it was important not to be too focused. You know, they found that sometimes they wanted them to just try to do work on the machines when they're not very, very focused on these REG machines. I think the point, though, is that John and Don produced an enormous body of work demonstrating a collective effect that deviated very much from chance. And I think to not credit them, they're one of the real titans of consciousness research. I think that they have an enormous contribution, and I think it's a real oversight to dismiss them.
So what do we do with people like that? I mean, how do we get it across to them?
Get it across to somebody like Henry Stapp?
He's doing...
Well, I think that, you know, I think you just only provide the evidence and you say, okay, well, let's look at the evidence. Let's look at the statistical method. How can you discredit the statistical method? It's a subtle effect, as they've seen, but it's still an effect.
Right.
And maybe we need to ask, we've asked them with random event generators. Maybe we ask this question with, maybe we'll be able to have more subtle equipment as time goes on that can ask a better question. But that's what science is all about. And the idea of dismissing it, I think, is the wrong thing. You might just want to ask a different question or come up with a new protocol or something to refine what you're finding about. That's what John and Dunn did all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They kept asking more questions. They took certain assumptions and they suddenly had to throw them out after a while because they had the assumption, for instance, that it was really important that the operators get feedback about whether they were having success or not.
Right.
And they realized after a while that was wrong. They shouldn't give them feedback.
Mm-hmm.
That these people were operating unconsciously. And even another thing that was more interesting that they found after a time was that their operators were having even a bigger effect when they were operating out of ordinary time and space sequences. You know, when they were trying to send retro intentions or intentions for 3 weeks hence, or they were not sitting in front of the machines but operating 1,000 miles away. So, once again, their assumptions were overthrown.
Mm-hmm.
That without the conventional time and space, there was an even bigger effect.
That's interesting. So, what relationship do you believe the zero-point field has to do with consciousness and manifestation of intention?
Well, I think zero-point field is consciousness. That's my definition of consciousness, and I think that it is that intention, our intention somehow taps into this consciousness, and that if you want to, it just purely as a mechanism, if you think that we are all one and we are all part of this field, then a thought is a tangible energy operating through this field. It's almost a little bit like being on a telephone network with everybody on the phone and just dialing that number and just using that network.
So what do you think resides down below? Well, let me back up a minute. Do you think the zero-point field is the dividing line of duality, perhaps?
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah. I think it probably is.
I do, too. I don't know that I think the zero-point field itself, because that's a temperature, is consciousness, but I certainly think it has to do with certainly the manifestation of intention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you think resides down below it? Just the void?
I don't know.
Which would be
I don't know if there is a below. I think that there is...
It's hard to describe it language.
Yeah, I don't know if there is a below. You know, it's like thinking, was there anything ever before this? I think maybe there is only this.
But that's a temperature. Bill Tiller and I got into this discussion one day, and he said, I was kind of like you, and he was like, Eva, it is a temperature.
No, well, I think it's language you're talking about. Bill Tiller likes the higher, when he talks about energy field. He talks about the vacuum.
Right.
And there are strict constructionists and loose constructionists.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, Bill is a strict constructionist who talks about the zero point field being an electromagnetic only field. Other people talk about the zero point field in a wider context and use it and not synonymously with the idea of the quantum vacuum.
Okay. That's
I just find the zero-point field is a nicer term. I tend to be a loose constructionist who like Hal Puthoff to use the term zero-point field to describe the vacuum. Because
okay.
The word vacuum is a hard concept for a layperson because it sounds like a void. And
right.
This is not a void, it's a plenum. It's full. It's a hive of activity. It's a giant repository of enormous energy.
Yes, it is.
And I think zero point field just is a nice concept. I think it's just a nice choice of language.
I'm glad you did that because that is a problem.
Yeah. Otherwise, you have this problem of, okay, what are you talking about? You're talking about just one aspect of the field. That's why I wanted to call it the field. Because then that sort of describes the whole idea, and it gives it a more popular name than
right.
Zero Point.
It's most excellent. I love it.
Thank you.
Okay. Why is a focused and intense state important in generating guided intention?
Okay, good
That's
question.
That's your question. So elaborate on that question for me to make sure assume that the audience has no idea what we're talking about.
Okay, well... the reason for that is I wanted to find out with my book, The Intention Experiment, I wanted to not only summarize the science of intention, but I wanted to find out what conditions make somebody a good intender. So I started interviewing a lot of so-called intention masters, like Qigong masters, master healers, all kinds of people like that, Buddhist monks. And I also studied a lot of the science to find out if there were certain conditions that made somebody, you know, made intention work better than others, so that I could design a very simple program people could follow to become good intenders. Mm-hmm. And I discovered one very important thing is a very focused mind state. However, a lot of people think of a focused mind state as a mind that is slowed down, you know, during meditation, a so-called alpha state, where, you know, the brain slows down to the kind of level of activity that occurs during light dreaming. But I found just the reverse with master intenders, that when they were sending intention, like the kinds of things Buddhist monks can do with their bodies, where they can change their metabolism by 60% or raise their temperature by 20 degrees, mm-hmm. when they were going through that kind of thing, their brains weren't slowing down. They were speeding up from a beta state, which is the brainwave, the brainwave cycles occurring in ordinary waking consciousness. They moved up to a gamma state. So that is like a brain operating much, much faster at a kind of peak intensity. It's like it's the brain that is focusing in and perceiving with every pore of your body. So it's that kind of highly focused thought that seems to help you move into a state where you actually affect physical matter. And it also, you also change the brain. You find brains, the brain actually enlarges very, very shortly after this kind of focused intention. It, certain structures enlarge. You become a bigger antenna and a bigger receiver. So it's quite interesting. So I think that this highly focused state, I talk about mindfulness meditation as a good way of practicing where you are attending to ordinary activity with all of your five senses without judgment. So if you're eating your cornflakes, you're focusing on what it smells like, what it tastes like as it's cascading down your throat, what it sounds like, all of those things, picking it all up and just trying to do that focus for about 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there, and just practicing that so that when you do intention, you get into a focused mind state initially through meditation, but then you work on high degree of focus.
Have you done any kind of experiments or watched anybody over the years where they've attempted to manifest something with intention and documented what kind of time it took for it to happen?
Well, what we're working on now is we've worked on intention experiments where we are doing experiments in, we have our targets in certain laboratories, and we invite our readers to come on the website every so often and do all of these intention experiments together. So we've worked on, you know, trying to make seeds grow faster and sprout quicker, and we have controlled experiments, so it means we've got the target, and we have a number of controls, so we can compare them. We've also have Intention of the Week, where this started by my readers, where they just, one of them, a Vietnam vet called Don Berry, just said, hey, I'll be an intention experiment, and he just asked the readers to send him an intention, because his spine is fused, he can't move, and he said, can you send an intention? And so the readers on their own got together and started to send him intention twice a week. And then I saw this was happening on my site, and I said, wow, let's start ritualizing this. So every week we have an Intention of the Week, and we put up somebody nominates somebody else who needs intention. So we've had people with cancer, we've had runaway children, we've had children who were born with birth defects, we have a kid who's got a horrible kidney disease recently, and all sorts of things like that. And we're trying that every single week. And we have some interesting successes. We have one, the teenage runaway, she was an angry, angry child, and we had her picture on there, this angry picture. And she was really, really thumbing her nose at her mom and had run away. And her mother wrote me 3 weeks later after we did the intention. And all we did was send an intention for she and her mother to have some sort of resolution and start communicating. And she said, I can't believe it. She's come home. She talked to me all about what was making her angry. She was hanging out with a rough crowd. She stopped doing that. Instead of having this really angry site on MySpace, it's now pink. And so it was quite amazing. And that happened within 3 weeks. So it's been really interesting. But I'm just so far, this is real early days. But, you know, we've only just started this. So we're asking some of these people who are our targets of intention to start keeping a diary. Let us know what happens.
Do you think that if you're going to do a mass intention like that, does it matter if everybody's going to have the exact same intention? Like, you know, you hear people pray and somebody prays for 30 minutes or somebody prays for a short time with a very focused intention. Does that seem to make a difference?
Well, because this is a scientific experiment, I'm talking about the real intention experiments where we've got a target in the lab. We ask people to do a number of things. Number one, I have a special password. I ask them to read my book. And the reason I want them to read my book is because I want them to follow the same procedure. I call it powering up that everyone else does. I don't want people who are trying different intentions and different ways of doing it, only because I need everybody to do all the same thing. Otherwise, it might mess up the scientific protocol. So we need everyone to follow exactly the same procedure, and we remind them when they go on the site. For the intention of the week, I still specify that we do it for 10 minutes, because I want to try to keep it to some sort of regularity. Mm-hmm. Do I know whether it makes a difference? I don't know. We should test this out. Do we need 10 minutes? Do we need 30 minutes? I don't know. And the only way we can find out is by testing it.
Also, one thing I wanted to ask about that was, it's just hard to put things like this into words. If you're having an intention, let's say you wanted to heal somebody's breast cancer,
mm-hmm.
would you say, would everybody need to focus, I want to heal the breast cancer, blah, 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 and give some kind of coordinates for it, or they could just pray or intend whatever thought they wanted to do as long as it lasted for whatever time. Is the specificity important?
I think it is. And what we've tended to do is turn it into something, instead of saying we want to kill the cancer, we say we want the cells to return to normal.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's in, you know, what we've tried to do, even with our intentions of the week, we specify the intention. We say, okay, at 5 p.m., we always do it exactly the same time. It's 5, it's, U.S. time, it's 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time. And so we do that all the time. Every single time we've done it at 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Saving Time and all the other time zones, you know, similar to that time.
Right.
So everybody's doing it at exactly the same moment. So for me in England, it's 6 p.m. English time at that point. And we all come on, we all do the intent. I ask them to click through on the same page, look at the picture, person's picture, and send the intention we have printed, which is, and we have it, my intention is for so-and-so to have such-and-such. And we all think the same thing for 10 minutes.
When will this end? When will this experiment be over? I can't wait to...
Well, the... it's ongoing. I mean, we have different experiments running. Our intention of the week, we just have it ongoing, and we report every so often with the results. The experiments we're running with the laboratories, we have loads of them planned. We've got, we've run ones where we've tried to affect the biophoton emissions, you know, the light emissions of a little leaf, and we've made it glow and glow, and we've had tremendous success with that, and we've demonstrated a significant effect there. And we're just in the process of replicating that. I've just did another intention experiment today with a group. So I've been doing experiments with particular groups when I'm speaking before them, and also we are doing experiments with our general readers when they come on the web. And now we have lots of plans. We're going to do our first one where we try to affect the pH of water. We try to clean up polluted water. And we're planning another one with an ecosphere, like a little mini Gaia, where we see if we can affect or lower the temperature. And that, of course, the implications of that for global warming would be extraordinary.
Absolutely.
I've been just speaking with Deepak Chopra, and he's very interested in trying to do an experiment through his Alliance for New Humanity. They know of and are documenting some of the levels of violence in certain hotspots, let's say in Central America. And I've talked to his co-founder. We just had several chats where we're going to try to pick a certain hotspot where the level of violence is carefully documented and send an intention to lower that violence level, and then we'll have our scientists measure the results afterward. We've got plans to have a human study and see what happens when we send intention, what happens physiologically to the person being sent intention by thousands of people. Maybe eventually, if we can demonstrate that that is a good effect, because we can't take anything for granted, then we will start trying to send intention maybe to children with attention deficit, a particular mm-hmm. school, or lower the mortality rate in a hospital. But it will always be a philanthropic target. That's the whole plan of the intention experiments. It's not about winning the lottery. It's about trying to alleviate the catalog of suffering on the planet.
Right. What made you do this, Lynn?
I guess I'm an investigative reporter by trade, and I'm a feet-on-the-ground type person who wants to show proof. And I guess I'm very drawn to the idea of spirituality and providing a scientific framework for spirituality for people in the West. We need to have proof. Sorry?
Is there a moment?
Was there a moment when I said I needed to do this? No, it was more a thing of, as I said, it was more like pulling a piece of string, where at first I was intrigued by all of these studies of spiritual healing and felt there's probably a energy field out there. I'm not sure what this is. And I really was a voyage without a compass. I really didn't know what I was going to find. And it was just the fact that as I started looking, I found these profound discoveries these scientists had made that were really not well known. And I felt, this is criminal. These people are changing our world. A new science is unfolding, right in front of my eyes, and I think the world needs to know about this.
I'll tell you something. I have a child that's 14, 13. Her science teachers have no idea this is going on.
No,
And when I tried to tell them, and they thought I was crazy. They didn't believe me.
Yes. Well, they don't. They've learned the whole old scientific model, and chances are they're not keeping up with what's going on in a lot of places in very, very, they're real forward-thinking frontier labs around the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, the work that's being done, say, in the University of Vienna's quantum energy group is really extraordinary stuff that is uncovering all kinds of new things about the way the world works. But your bog-standard scientist isn't going to really know very much about this. So these are, the pockets of the frontier of the frontier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I felt most of these guys had dug deep and found something really profound, and that perhaps I could make a contribution by turning this into something in a lay language that ordinary people could understand.
What do you think about Bill Tiller's discovery of magnetic monopoles?
I think it's amazing. I think first of all, we need to replicate it. Somebody outside of his sphere mm-hmm. needs to replicate it, and that will be really good for establishing more credibility for him.
There is a group in Japan. Now, I don't know if I found this the other day and sent it to him. There is a group in Japan that's discovered them, too, so I'm hoping the two of them will at least collaborate. You might look into that sometime.
I think it's really interesting. There are, there are some people looking into some of this, but I'd really like to see this on a big scale because I think what he's discovering is really interesting about the whole idea that that intention somehow changes and orders and conditions the space. And I think if that's true, then it is, it means that you are, when you are sending an intention, you are accessing a different reality. It gives us a model as to how some of this works. I think that I'd like to see other scientists examine and test out some of his remarkable theories. And I think that would really be a step forward.
Yeah, he's an amazing man.
He really is.
So we've got about 12 or 13 minutes left. Why don't you pick one or two pieces of the scientific evidence that's in your newest book that's your favorite and tell my listeners about it.
Okay. I guess my favorite and a lot of the readers' favorites has to do with a lot of the evidence that I was looking at about how the body deals with thoughts and why thoughts are so powerful to the body. And probably one of the most fun examples of this, I mean, I always say that the brain, being remarkable as it is a little bit dumb because it can't really distinguish between an action and a thought. And
that's
it can't,
right.
You know, and it can't distinguish between the thought of a pill and an actual pill, which is why the placebo effect works so
that's
well.
Right.
But one of the really interesting aspects of this was a study that was done by Cleveland Clinic, and they wanted to see whether or not they wanted to see whether there was any difference between going to the gym and thinking about going to the gym.
I want to know that one, too.
Well, you'll be gratified by the answer here, because they found that, you know, they took a group, they divided them in half, and they sent half to the gym. And those people went to the gym, and they worked on their biceps, and they found that they increased their bicep size by 30%. Then they sent another group just to their armchairs and had them thinking about going to the gym. And they found that they increased their bicep size by 15%.
No way.
They did.
Okay.
And there have been, and so, you know, this is great comfort to those of us who really don't like going to the gym.
Yeah, so I can intend and melt away 10 or 15 pounds if I just sit there and do art enough.
You bet. You bet. Well, you know, there were some other studies of, like, hypnosis. And hypnosis is another kind of mental intention by someone sending it right through to your subconscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been many, many instances where women have been able to enlarge their breasts by several sizes.
Really?
Just by mentally intending it. Yep. And there's even most incredible of all is a guy called Dr. Angel Escudera in Spain who is able to do surgery without anesthesia because he tells people to just imagine and think that their mouths are full of saliva. And the reason he does that is when the first thing that happens when you're tense or stressed in any way is that your mouth dries up. If the brain thinks that the mouth is full of saliva, that's kind of the signal to the body that everything is okay. And so if you can convince your brain that your mouth is full of saliva by just thinking about it, it won't register that it's having pain when somebody is cutting up a leg.
Oh, my God. That's
so it's quite amazing what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been even filmed doing this. It's quite incredible.
It's amazing. Well, I have a philosophical question for you here. Do you believe that we have complete free will?
I believe there are quantum tendencies, meaning I believe also that our future and our present are constantly shaking hands.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean that future conditions are always acting on the present. So that doesn't really argue for determinism. It argues much more that there are certain tendencies that, you know, almost like forks in the road, and you can
mm-hmm.
slightly go one way or slightly go another way, and that you've got certain directions mapped out, but that they aren't set in stone.
I agree. So let's talk about, for a minute, let me see how much time we have. 10:48, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes. The Secret.
Mm-hmm.
So many people that watch that show think that they can go out and manifest $1 million by next week.
Yes.
What's wrong with that?
Okay, well, there's several things wrong with it. First of all, I want to say that I think The Secret did some really good things in that it introduced a lot of people to the idea of consciousness and intention and the idea that a thought is a thing that can affect other things. I think that it was trying very hard to be very basic and to present this in a very simple way. I think just talking to intention masters and studying all the science I have is that it isn't just about happy thoughts, that there are probably certain conditions that make intention work much better than others.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that it's a misreading of many of the the people who have written about the law of attraction, like Napoleon Hill, to think it's just about manifesting money and manifesting stuff. Yes, Napoleon Hill wrote about getting and receiving, you know, riches and things, but he also talked about working very hard and fixedly about things. You know, you focus your intention on it, but then you work with every fiber of your being toward getting it.
You got to move your feet.
You got to move your feet, but also then the third thing he talked about was giving back. You don't just get, you give back. There's like an energy that happens almost cyclically. So it's not just, and that gets left out. You know, you don't just sit and go, okay, my turn. You know?
I believe that has to do with polarity and magnetic monopoles, if you want to know the truth.
Well, it's an interesting thought, you know, to think it that way. But certainly these people who are the sort of architects of these ideas, we're talking about giving as well as receiving.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that one day we'll find out that those magnetic monopoles have something to do with the energy exchange and thought,
mm-hmm.
and intention, and what goes out and what comes back in. When
well, it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting concept to think about that. I think there were a lot of good ideas that were in there, and it was a very inspiring movie, which is why it touched so many people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that from my own research, there are many more sophisticated conditions that I think make for good intention.
Right.
But I think the simple message that, you know, you are what you think and that you attract what you think about all the time is a really good message.
Do you think that, you know, perhaps the reason it doesn't happen maybe for somebody is because it takes a while for physical mass to create in physical reality, so they're living today what they manifested 10, 15 years ago, and whatever it is they're trying to do perhaps will happen 5, 10, 15 years from now?
I've never actually thought of it that way. I thought many people don't get what they try to manifest, you know, in terms of thinking because they don't really believe it. You know, they don't really believe it. They have other experiences in their past that have created a subconscious belief system that really sabotages what they're trying to manifest.
Possibly so. Well, you've got about 3 minutes. Do you have a favorite story?
I guess in my 3 minutes, I'd like to just talk a little bit about, you know, what the implications of all of this are, and that, you know, our understanding is now unfolded that we are, you know, far more than we seem, and that if our thoughts are rippling back and forth through the galaxy and affecting things, if we're all affecting each other, if we're all part of a giant energy field, if we are all one, and we are influencing at every moment, then first of all, our human potential is just a glimmer of what it could be.
Mm-hmm.
Our understanding now is just a glimmer of what it could be. And more importantly, all of our societal structures, our relationships, our educational structures, our economic structures, our societal structures like our towns and cities and planet, we have to start changing. We have to really review how we've set these things up, because we set them all up now based on competition and separation. And what we really have to look at is building new structures that promote unity and promote cooperation. And one of the things that we're starting is a field foundation, a nonprofit foundation that is involving businesses in this, so that businesses will have an incentive. We've created a special incentive for them to create their companies so that the world is their business, and that their work is about promoting unity in some way, both inside the structure, but also what they do out there.
Now, where's their information about that?
It will
really
be on our website. We're just starting this now, and we're starting in Holland, although we'll be, of course, applying all of this to the rest of the world. The reason we're starting in Holland is that is a very spiritual country, and we have already interested a number of big organizations like the airlines KLM and IBM, representatives from a lot of big industries like this, to start bringing these ideas into their company. There's even some companies who want to, big companies who want to work on intention experiments with us.
Amazing. That's wonderful.
So we will have that on our website, livingthefield.com, and we'll be, as this unfolds, and as I say, this is a very new thing, people can join. They also can join our Living the Field groups, because if we have to learn another way to be, we're all a little bit like a Christopher Columbus without a compass.
Mm-hmm.
So these are groups that are establishing themselves all over the world of people who live in close proximity, or they want to communicate just in cyberspace, who are exchanging this information. And we've got a very, very lively website that that has people talking about this all over the world.
Lynn, all I can say is what a great job you've done. And I thank you. Everything that you've done, it's so important in the world.
Well, Eva, thank you so much. It's been a real joy to be on the show with you and to spend this time with you.
And they can get your book where?
They can get my book all over the place. On Amazon, it's The Intention Experiment, or on our website, theintentionexperiment.com.
Thanks a lot for coming on, and I actually hope you'll come back. You've got so much information that people are starving for it, you know.
Well, I'd love to anytime, Eva.
So agape to you and your journeys, and come back soon.
Thanks so much.
Good night.